Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 28th, 2002. Today's session is titled Perspectives on the Land, Understanding Palestinian Perspectives on the Land. And it's hosted by Esther Min. It's session MEE 2002-4. Let's listen in.
Out in the rain. We'll get started on time so the tape ministry people can get started with the other one as well. My name is Esther Min, and I teach biblical studies at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. But here at Holden this week, I've been talking about perspectives on the land. And tonight we're going to look at Palestinian perspectives on the land. I wanted to start by reading you a poem called The Impossible, which is written by Fouzi al-Asmar, a Palestinian poet. This is called The Impossible. Don't ask me the impossible. Don't ask me to hunt the stars, walk to the sun. Don't ask me to empty the sea, to erase the day's light. I am nothing but a man. Don't ask me to abandon my love, my eyes, the memory of my childhood. I was raised beneath an olive tree. I ate the figs of my orchard, drank wine from the sloping vineyards, tasted cactus fruits in the valley. More, more. The bluebird has sung in my ear, and the free wind of the field and city has always touched me. Therefore, my friend, it is impossible to ask me to abandon my homeland. So in this poem, he speaks of his memory, what his eyes have seen, and his childhood, and of such concrete things as an olive tree, figs, orchards, a certain feel of the wind and so forth, that really deep attachment to a particular place that so many of the people of Palestine have. Attachment to traditional lands, to farms that have been in families for generations, for hundreds of years. And not only just to lands, but there's patterns of settlement of families together. And so it's a matter of social contacts and ways of life as well. To the fields and the cities, villages, to Jerusalem, which is the third holiest site in Islam after Mecca and Medina. So the land was not, as the Zionists claimed, a land without people, for a people without a land. The land had a people. It was inhabited. It wasn't densely inhabited. There were empty spaces. And the boast that it was the Israelis that made the desert bloom, that's true. They came and they began a lifestyle that was much more productive with the use of water and so forth. But it could be argued that the low density of population was appropriate for a very arid climate, and the water issues that are currently of such proportion right now show that there really are a lot of people on that little plot of land right now. Currently, there are about 3.5 million refugees that are, and their descendants, that are living outside of their land. And for many of them, their heart is still in this land. So I think that we can, as Americans, we can see some parallels with the American settlement of the West. And that was one of the sessions that I dealt with earlier about Lakota memories and the Lakota experience of the land and ties to the land. In that we have the same kind of settling of a settled land, the inhabitation of an inhabited land, and the displacement of an indigenous peoples. But there's a lot of differences as well that make this particular case and complicate it in a particular way. Each instance has its own particulars. But in this case, what complicates it from the Jewish perspective, as we studied last time, is that historic connection of the Jewish people to that particular land and to their presence in that land throughout history, even though a minority presence for most of that time. And what also complicates it from the Jewish perspective is the recent events in world history. So the persecution of the Jews in Russia and the Shoah or the Holocaust in Europe. So that Israel is not just a land, but it's a haven, it's a place of safety, and the right of return for every Jewish person, that right to come and to have open borders is insurance. It's a way of making sure that the kind of catastrophe that happened in this century will never happen again. So from the Jewish perspective, this complicates the situation. When we look at other particulars, we can see that the land of Palestine, Israel, what we call Israel and Palestine now, that land was much more densely populated than, for example, the American land. There were approximately 1947.
That's good.
In 1947, when the UN partitioned the land, there were about 1.5 million Palestinians living there in the very small space, whereas estimates are, although they're open to debate, that there may have been about 1 million indigenous peoples in what's now the United States and Canada, in this vast area. So we're talking about a much denser population, and it was a population with connections to a greater Arab world as well. And it's further complicated by the fact that the people that came in, the Jewish people, had actually a lot in common with these people. They both spoke Semitic languages, Hebrew and Arabic. They both are Semitic peoples from the three Abrahamic religions. So you have Islam, Judaism, and Christianity right there. So it becomes very, very complex and unique, and kind of a pressure cooker here. Now, I just want to highlight a couple of points in history, so review very quickly some of what we went over last night when we were talking about Jewish and Israeli perspectives on the land. I don't want to repeat everything. I know a lot of people were here. Just out of curiosity, how many people were here last night? Oh, 2 days ago. I'm sorry. I lose track of time. Okay, so only about half. So I'll just hit a couple of highlights. After I got done with that presentation, Rabbi Mark said to me, his analysis was, "Oh, you sound like you're giving the liberal Palestinian view of the Israeli perspective." And I said to him, I said, "You know, that's probably true, Rabbi Marks. But when I give the Palestinian perspective, I'm going to give the liberal Israeli view of the Palestinian perspective." So you can see that I try very hard to be fair to both sides. And I invite you, if you have some further insight about anything that I'm saying, or if you can clarify something, or if you have any questions, please hop in as I'm speaking. I would appreciate that. Well, so just to repeat a few points from last night, but now trying to take a bit more of the Palestinian perspective. As we said last night, there was resistance already to the idea of a Jewish state under the British Mandate and a rejection of the United Nations partition by the Arab populations. this whole idea that there would be two separate lands with a Jewish state and a shared Jerusalem was not acceptable to the Arab majority. So there were 1.5 million Palestinians at this point, and about 600,000 Jewish people in the land. Okay, so the partition was to give 55% to, well, I'll do it in this order again. It was to give 45% to the Arab inhabitants and 55% to the Jewish inhabitants. So this would be about 1/4, right, and about 3/4. So you can see this is off. And also this number is very high, because if you just go back to 1900, there were only about 10% of Jews in the land. So with the World War and other persecutions, there had been an influx, a very dramatic influx. So this was considered unacceptable. But in 1948, there was the Declaration of Independence of the Jewish state. So we have Yom Ha'atzma'ut, the Independence Day, in 1948. And this was called by a different name, though, among the Arabs. So names are important. Have you heard what this is called among the Arabs? Anybody know that term? Okay, this is called, instead of the Day of Independence, this is called Al-Nakba. Has anybody ever heard that before? Al-Nakba, that means the catastrophe, the disaster. And there's a very famous song that you can hear on the streets in the old city of Jerusalem and probably other places, but I lived in Jerusalem, so you would hear it, and it's about this catastrophe of the loss of the land. And in fact, it wasn't only this land, but as the surrounding Arab states attacked the newly declared state of Israel, Israel reacted and took 23% more land. So you start subtracting that. About 22%, right? That would be in what we now call the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So you can see why it would be called Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. And then we have in 1967, the next big event in the story of the land is when, once again, surrounding Arab nations that still would not accept Israel as a presence in the region, as a state in the region, they attacked from the West Bank, using the West Bank as a launching point. And Israel, once again, responded with a very strong military show and took over the remaining 22%. So Israel then, in the Six-Day War, this is so quick. took the West Bank and Gaza, so that 22% remaining. And they also then took the Sinai, which had belonged to Egypt, and the Golan Heights. And Sinai has since been returned to Egypt, 1981, and there were negotiations about the Golan Heights. So now these areas, the West Bank and Gaza, are also under Israeli control. And how you call these lands also is a matter of perspective, right? They've been called the occupied territories. And that would be a statement of solidarity with the Palestinian people there, the occupied territories. Because In 1967, the same year, the UN issued an important resolution, 242, that that ordered Israel to retreat from these lands that it had seized in war and to go back to defensible borders. Now, that was a little bit ambiguous because apparently that these borders weren't defensible, but okay.
Was that the 1947 area, though?
Yes.
That they were claiming that border?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Was the border that they were saying go back to your, was it the 1947 border?
Yes, but no, they didn't really specify. They just called it, it was a bit vague, actually. And so it's been, but basically, yes, because people use this 242 on both sides, actually. So the occupied territories, that would be saying that, yes, Israel is occupying territories and should return them, or, you know, that this is the state of occupation. The right in Israel would call them Samaria. So it would be Judea and Samaria, part of Greater Israel. Or contested territories. In other words, the fate of these territories is still open to negotiation. So, but whatever you call it, Israel has been in control of all those areas. Now there's a problem. There was not a strong desire to annex this territory because that would mean that there would be a demographic tip so that there would be a very large Arab population within Israel's borders. Now in 1980, there was an annexation of east of neighborhoods in East Jerusalem into Israel, but the rest has remained and is still open to various negotiations and military incursions in these latter days.
Can you say again, the Six-Day War, did the Israelis just decide to take over that 22%, or did something happen?
There was a amassing of Arab forces, kind of a coalition, including a number of states, Egypt, Iraqi, Syrian. I mean, so an amassing of a number of Arab states on the West Bank, and then up through the Sinai, and so in response to that, at least this is one way of telling the story. But there was the presence of military buildup in any event of Arab nations. Mm-hmm. So from the Israeli point of view, this is unfair. We were attacked, and therefore now we can't retreat to these same borders from which, you know, which were indefensible. So that's the Israeli point of view. But the problem remains that there's this population that already was living on such a small percentage of its lands and now is under control of Israel.
Esther?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The issue, I suppose this is, you can't really answer this, but it seems to me they defended those borders pretty well in the Six-Day War, since it only lasted 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that they can say that those they aren't defensible? Mm-hmm. Or is it just that we have the land, therefore it's just because they decide to define it as indefensible?
Could I answer that?
Okay.
The Golan Heights, for one, was a military position that controlled the land under it. They could put artillery, etc., up there and just shoot that out of anybody that was down below. And sure, the line was defensible, but the not controlling those heights was not a military good thing.
Right. And there were attacks on the surrounding kibbutzim, you know, down from the, for example, the Golan. Yeah, well, I guess the issue is, once you get the territory, do you then give it up and then possibly this will keep happening over and over. I don't know. So that, anyway, this was the concern on the Israeli point. And people still call for that, the UN Resolution 242, which stated the inadmissibility of acquisition of territory by war, and called for Israel to return to its defensible borders. You know, there's the fuzzy thing, and Sharon also quotes 242. Yes, we're to return to our defensible borders. Well, what are those? We have to determine those. Well, then beginning a little bit later here, in the 70s, and especially in the 90s, we have settlements. Being built within the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So this is another encroachment on the areas that are traditionally, and from 1947 officially, the Arab lands. And it's shocking that since Oslo in 1993, the population of the settlements has doubled. So even as there were peace talks, it's gone up to 200,000 settlers in the territories. And this may not, you know, this 200,000, what's that? But now listen to this. B'Tselem is the name. B'Tselem means in the image, and it's the name of an Israeli peace group. So I like to quote and would like to support a lot of the Israeli peace movements and so forth that are really grappling with these issues within themselves. So this is from an Israeli peace group called B'Tselem. It's a human rights group, really, in the image of God. They say that of the territories, of the occupied territories, only 1.7% of the lands are actually involved in these settlements. So 1.7, so that's not very much. But the boundaries of the settlements are larger, so they take up 6.8% of the land. So, you know, the actual buildings and so forth, 1.7. The boundaries, 6.8. Well, that still didn't sound so bad. But then you start getting roads, and you get territory that's controlled by regional councils for security, and that's 35.1%. So when you add all that up in the West Bank, 41.9% of the West Bank is effectively controlled by these settlement councils and the security issues that they raise.
Can you explain or describe what the settlements are like?
Oh, okay. Well, the settlements, they can start out simply, and in fact, although there's officially a freeze right now, another peace group, Peace Now, has said that there are 34 new ones. So what does that mean? It can mean something as simple as a group of settlers, and often they come from New York, so they don't have any sensitivity to the dynamics in the area anyway, and they're New Yorkers. Can you imagine that? I mean, even if they came to Holden, we'd notice they stick out, but anyway. So they could just come to a hill. In fact, Sharon, when he was housing minister, he would say, seize every height, you know. So. And you would see on, I have some friends in East Jerusalem, Palestinian friends, and they would watch TV all the time. And so they would watch, you know, the Arab news stations and the Palestinian stations and so forth. And you would see these Israelis from New York walking up hills. And they would bring their, what do you call those? They're not recreational vehicles.
Trailers,
thank you. They bring their trailers up there, and that's a settlement. And
so was there anyone living on the hill already?
No. There's no one living on the hill.
But they they blocked off the villages or vineyards or olive trees below. mm-hmm. and blocked off the roads to the, they didn't actually live on the hill. Mm-hmm. The Palestinians mm-hmm. lived down below and then mm-hmm. shut their
yes.
water and transportation.
You're naming all the things that happen after a settlement starts in a simple way of living, a few people living on a hill. Well, yes, then you need water, and then you need roads, and you need roads that will get you quickly through what might be hostile areas because you've actually taken somebody's traditional lands, you know, and then it goes on, and then here's what's happened though. More officially is that there have been incentives by the government, low mortgage, low taxation, utilities and roads provided and so forth for these settlements. And so it's very easy to move from, say, a crowded apartment in Jerusalem. All you have to do is go out half an hour or so, and you can have a big house, and it's comfy. And now the under Sharon, the settlements are officially frozen to just natural growth. And actually, this has helped the settlements in that instead of putting energy in more settlements, what's happened is you have the enhancement and expansion of the services. You know, so you have schools in the settlements, you have commercial districts, you have industrial areas. So really, it's setting up a whole
supermarkets.
Yeah, the whole thing. So it's a little community. And very cheap living, and so we have various sizes from, you know, nice very big ones to three ones.
And they have some security fencing around them, or security cleared area, or.
Well, this is interesting because some of the religious groups, Gush Emunim, for example, is a religious group, a rightist group that sees. Greater Israel, you know, all of Israel is divinely given by God to Jews, and so they do not put up fences because they see themselves that's their land, and so they're not going to. But there are various security systems in some places. Some places are surrounded by wires and so forth. But there's a military presence as well. So reserve, you know, the army will patrol and so forth, will protect these settlers. And this is controversial even within Israeli politics because Likud, the more right party, supports these settlements, whereas Labor is more reticent, especially about the settlements in, you know, the more densely Palestinian areas. So Labor would just as soon not have those there, you know, right in the middle there. But because Israeli politics is what it is, you have to have coalition governments. I mean, even Sharon's government has both Likud and Labor. And so policies just kind of keep going just to have a majority rule. I don't know, does that give you some idea of what they are? There are a number in the Gaza Strip too, and the most sort of the glaring symbol of some of those is the swimming pools that they have in just an incredibly poor region, you know, and densely populated region, and also a region with very little water. So those are very, very controversial. So sometimes you'll hear about, you know, Palestinians coming in and being shot by the settlers, and they're maybe making an attack or something. You know, it could have been their home, their traditional lands, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The impression is that people, even though they've said there's a freeze, they're generally kind of spreading out to say, "Hey, we're already on this land." Are there any Jewish people are? Are there any Palestinian settlements doing the same sort of thing?
Well. You mean settlements within Israel, or what? What would that mean?
Yeah, within this region.
Within this region.
If Palestinians are living there, mm-hmm. and they see that people are spreading out and, you know, to claim the land, I would think the natural instinct would be to spread out also.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. What you have is, in the West Bank, you have some very traditional areas of dense Palestinian population already. And so, you know, it's already densely populated there. And I don't know what it would mean to make settlements necessarily. The economy is not good right now. I mean, the money for the settlements, there's so much support from the outside, from Jewish organizations throughout the world. The money's coming from outside, so I don't know what it would mean to make a Palestinian settlement since, you know, the people are there and the economy's bad. What I should probably turn to is, we've raised issues of settlement and so forth, population, is I should probably turn to kind of the patterns now of settlement and control in the West Bank, and that may illustrate a few things. But what I should say before I leave this subject of the settlements is that it's really, as far as the Israelis are concerned, it's really an impasse, because what's going to happen is if the West Bank as a whole is going to be set aside along with the Gaza Strip for a Palestinian state, then that's going to mean that these settlers are going to have to be removed. And there are some very well-developed homes and now communities from the 70s already there. And so it looks like a civil war in a way. In other words, you're going to have Jewish soldiers removing Jewish settlers. So anyway, we'll leave that, since we're not, see, this is the Israeli, this is, as I was telling Rabbi Marks, it's going to be the Israeli liberal presentation of the Palestinian side. I can't help but bringing in both sides, even as we speak. Well, what happened then at Oslo in 1993? It looked very promising. This was after the first Intifada, you know, in 18. Going way back, in 1987, we had the first Intifada or uprising. And it was generally a resistance movement where the people said, this is enough. There has been too much of an assault on our lands, on our water rights. And we're the labor in this country, which is true. The labor force was largely the Arab peoples and the Palestinian peoples. A lot of people came across the border and so forth. So there were strikes, violence, all kinds of things to protest the situation. And it set off a number of negotiations and so forth. And in the end, Yasser Arafat himself in 1988 comes to the point of condemning terror and recognizing the state of Israel. So this is something completely, completely new here. This is all happening kind of in this moment of ferment. And then you have in 1991 the Madrid conference, which nothing really happened, but secretly Oslo was happening. So with Oslo, there was a declaration of principles, and you know that was with between Arafat and Rabin and Peres. And what Oslo did then is that it granted Palestinian control of certain areas, and that would include both civil and some policing duties. So the Palestinian Authority had police forces, armed police forces, in some areas, Area A. And these are going to be, I'm going to pass this around, the dark areas, or Areas A, around the centers of population, such as Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah, Jericho, Bethlehem, and so forth. Then there was Area B, and that was where the Palestinian Authority would have control, civil control, but not military control. And then there was Area C, which is where the Israelis would have control. Anyway, I'll pass this around. So there are these tiny little pockets of Palestinian control, both civil and police control. Now, this seems like progress in a way. It's rather exciting. But look, it ends up with these small little islands that look a lot like what we saw when we looked at the Lakota people and how the Great Sioux Reservation was divided into six reservations, and then those two were eaten up. So anyway, I'll just pass that around. The darker ones are the areas of Palestinian control. And at Jericho, one of these areas, a casino was set up, which even makes the parallel to the American reservations more poignant. So you have an interim Palestinian government, and this is really historic. You also have the agreement, the Palestinians agree to take up as their home and land only 22%. So if you remember, I mean, there was a rejection even of the existence of the State of Israel, but now by the Oslo Accords in 1993, you have recognition of the State of Israel and the agreement that the Palestinian state would be on 22% of the land as it was before partition. But there were so many important issues that hadn't been decided. Yeah, but they were reserved because they were considered too explosive. Can you help me list these?
Jerusalem,
yes. Whose is Jerusalem?
The return of refugees.
The refugees, the return of the refugees. Mm-hmm. And compensation of the refugees. The borders, right?
Entry of more Palestinians.
What's that?
Entry of more Palestinians.
So yes, the entry of more Palestinians. So the right of return for Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Settlements.
And the settlements, good. So these are like the really hot issues. You can also say water and other kinds of rights would be another issue. So these were the issues that were sort of too hot to handle at that time. And so we've had a number of different, the Y Accord, Y2, and on and on. And so really things came to a head in 2000, right, at Camp David. Where President Clinton brings in the leaders. Barack, who has been elected on a peace platform. So Netanyahu's been kicked out of office, and Barack is elected. And I was there when he was elected in 99. It was very exciting. All the peace movements, they were very excited. And I remember staying up till 4 and hearing all throughout the neighborhood, the Israelis, because I was in Western Jerusalem, were listening to the news and listening, to the returns, and listening then to Barack's acceptance speech. Like at 4 in the morning, he got 60% of the vote. So he had this mandate to make peace. And so there they were at Camp David. And what happened? It was a climactic moment. And the way it's portrayed in the news, or the way it was portrayed, was Clinton was very disappointed with Arafat and said it was a historic moment and Arafat's responsible for the failure, because Barack went farther, and offered 99% of all that the Palestinians wanted and so forth. So Arafat had a lot of blame placed on him. And then there was a subsequent meeting at Taba and things moved a little farther. But then what you have the Second Intifada, which is a much more violent one now that people are armed. And you have, and more desperate as well. And you have also the election of Ariel Sharon, who has no interest in Oslo or for the whole concept of land for peace. And so that's really kind of like this. But what happened at 2000? And was Arafat really to blame for the failure? It's an interesting question, and people will probably be debating that for a long time. And I'm hoping that at some point, some of the goodwill and momentum of that moment can be recovered, and we can go on from there. But in any event, let me just ask you, have you heard that accusation that Arafat is to blame for the...
Yeah.
Have you heard some of the counter arguments to that as well?
No.
Not so much. Yes, rather quietly, but there were a number of interesting articles that came out. And we can look at some of the issues. Perhaps the first issue we should look at is the land. Because it was said that Barak was offering 95% of the land, that 22%, and that sounds very generous. But that Arafat was holding out for, you know, exactly the 67 borders. Well, what Barak and that camp proposed was to take some of the, and I'll pass this around too, I'm sorry. I should have like a big blow up, but was to take some of the areas that were most densely settled right around the eastern edge of Israel proper, and to incorporate those. Then what would happen is that there, along the border, the Jordan River, and all the way down the border, the borders, they would be under temporary control of the Israeli army. So that would be the border with Jordan, as well as the borders with Israel down below. And so this would mean that it's still the majority of the land, but when you look at this closely, you'll see that, once again, there's little pockets. So there's the separation of one section from the other, and the proposal was to give a small section of the Negev in exchange. One of the articles said, well, it was only 1/9 of what was going to be given, but you know, to give, you know, some desert land in exchange. But if you look at that, there was no territorial continuity. It was fragmented, split apart, with settlement blocks, bypass roads, roadblocks. And Israel demands that Palestinians relinquish land reserves essential for their development and the absorption of refugees. They also must accept Israeli supervision of border crossings together with many other restrictions. So I'll pass this around. So let me tell you where this comes from too. As I said, I like to go with the internal critique. You know, that's hard to do, especially when you feel that your people is under assault. This is by, not in my name, and it's American Jews who are against Israel's policies toward the Palestinians. So I'll just pass that around. Yes?
When you say that area would be incorporated, do you mean into Israel?
Yes, it would be incorporated into Israel.
So some of the densely populated Palestinian part would be incorporated into Israel?
Well, it would be the settlements that are just on, you know, there's Jerusalem, and then there's a lot of settlements that are just on the border.
But it's currently Palestinian.
It's currently part of that pre-67 land. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't look like a lot of land, but if you look how it cuts it into small areas again. And what one thing that this recent incursion starting in March into those Palestinian-controlled areas has pointed out to me with great sadness is they are so vulnerable. They can be surrounded and cut off at any time. You know, it really, they start feeling almost more like a prison. So the land was one issue. The other issues were Jerusalem. And it is true that Barak was thinking creatively and even came up with the idea that Israel would maintain control of the area under the Temple Mount, mm-hmm. or the Haram HaSharif, right? The former site of the temple and where the Dome of the Rock is and Al-Aqsa Mosque, whereas the Palestinian state would have control of the area above the ground. So they were trying to come up with some creative solutions.
What is under
and
the ground?
What's that?
What is under the ground? Is there something under the ground?
Oh, the old temple.
Yeah, no one has dug under there, but...
Catacombs or something?
There's... It's the site of the old temple. You really can't dig below it. But it was more of a kind of what is it, kind of a, I don't know, a legal dance, right? Yes, you own it, but we own it, that kind of thing. Not really giving up either. Wait, and there were some proposals that the Palestinians would control the Muslim and Christian quarters of the old city, as well as some of the neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. But one of the critiques I read was that these were never proposed directly to Arafat, but kind of floated through others, and that the plans were never clearly laid. And also, what would be the relationship of the Palestinian areas in the West Bank and Gaza to Jerusalem, to these Palestinian areas in Jerusalem? Because there's, so how would people even get there? So there were really unresolved problems with Jerusalem as well, even though you can see that there was creative thinking, and I think Barak went farther than anyone has ever gone. But the question of whether it was acceptable to the whole Palestinian people is another issue. And that really came to a head, I think, with the refugee issue, because it was vaguely stated that it would be dealt with in an appropriate manner. And so it was too vague, really. If Arafat had agreed to that, what would that mean? It wasn't ironed out yet, so that was still an issue that remained. And I think that many Palestinians were already seeing that Arafat was making a lot of compromises with Barak and the Israeli government, and it's unclear how much support, even if Arafat had agreed to that, how much support he would have actually had to make that move. Anyway, that moment is past. But I'm hoping we can get back to something like that, because certainly since March, things have gotten a lot worse with the suicide bombing during Passover. There was the movement of tanks into Ramallah and all of the centers of population, and just massive destruction of the infrastructures, of buildings and of utilities. And I don't know, do some of you keep track of what's happening with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan, for example, the church at Bethlehem? Does anybody hear anything about this?
No one already went into the church or something.
Yes, uh-huh. But I'm curious, how many people have heard anything about any of this? So it's relatively new materials. Yes. So, you know, door-to-door searches, and in this case, entry into a church and destruction of the properties, you know, really kind of gratuitous, it sounds like, in many cases. Mass arrests of the men from ages 14 to 45 and so forth, just things that are very, very devastating. And of course, then the accusations of massacre in Jenin, and the whole question of whether international observers would be allowed in, and they weren't. And personally, I don't think that there was a massacre, but I think it was most unfortunate that they didn't allow people in right away. The destruction was terrible, right? They met resistance, armed resistance, and there was a battle there, and people were killed, and a lot of houses were bulldozed to widen the streets, and you know, just massive destruction. I don't think that there was a massacre, and one of the reasons is because everybody has cell phones in the Israeli army and is talking to home, you know, so you hear a lot of different reports about what's happening, and they haven't found the bodies and so forth, but just horrible things. And then there was the retreat for a while, but now after this last set of suicide bombings, now Sharon has retaken all of these major areas, eight areas, and except Jericho, right? Still Jericho, apparently, is, I don't know. Did somebody just come in today? This is happening now. And with...
What about the fences they're putting up now?
Oh, this is a whole new thing, too. This whole idea of how to disengage, yes, to put up a wall. A wall. For that, now that's going to separate family from family again, and keep people from their jobs. The unemployment rate is about 50% or more already. So a wall, or surrounding these major areas, these cities with barbed wire and trenches, cutting off travel, requiring permits to leave, and you have to renew the permit every month, and you can only travel between something. I wrote the times down on one of these things from like sometime in the morning to 7 at night. So it sounds, you know, it sounds more and more like a prison, which is really alarming because I can't, you know, I can't imagine how, where we're going to go. Where's the positive vision? That's the thing that we need now is a positive vision. It seems like that Sharon can only think in military terms. And, you know, maybe the hope is that, you know, that'll stop the suicide bombings, but that hasn't happened. And Hamas, and for one, and Islamic Jihad and others have said that they're going to continue the war of buses, the bombing of buses, because, well, they do not still recognize the existence of the State of Israel. So,
and very sad. Apparently has no control over them.
No, I think that he's not leading this current outbreak, but, you know, because the Palestinian Authority is a secular organization, administration, whereas Hamas, Islamic Jihad, they're Islamicists, they're fundamentalists, and then you also have students as well that are kind of leading out in the forefront. So, more recently, there has been a group, Al-Aqsa Brigade, that has been connected with his organization, which is a very loose kind of umbrella organization. So, to what extent he controls that is another issue as well. So I look for positive voices. So what do we find in this time of desperation, really? One of the most positive things I've read, I'll just share a couple very briefly and then ask for some of your comments, is a report by Edward Said from The Nation, and he criticizes both the Israeli government very strongly. They're oppressive and illegal occupation and the whole posturing of Israel as a victim when they're so strong. He also criticizes Arafat and the whole peace process from Oslo on, which he thinks is so accommodating to the Israelis. So he's pointing to a new group, which he finds very encouraging. Well, he says here's a little bit of hope, although it may be changing with all this military action, is that between Arafat and his Islamicist opponents, they only get 40 or 45% of popular approval. So there is a silent majority that wants to live in peace in its own nation that's not tied with either of those. And he names a whole list of people, a very visible group for true independence and popular status. And he talks about a group of very disciplined Palestinian youths meeting together and leaders such as Mustafa Barghouti, who has a lot of respect. He's a doctor, has a lot of respect in the Palestinian community, and he spoke out against the occupation. And there was no violence at this meeting, and they arrested Barghouti, and the Israelis did, and broke his knee and so forth, and injured his head, but he came out and was still talking. And so it's in this kind of movement, sort of a peaceful movement by the Palestinians, that Edward Said sees the future. And I hope so much that he's right. I want to support him. And another thing I want to point out that I find very positive, and I think I'll be able to say more about this tomorrow when at 10:45 when I talk about Christian perspectives on the land, is the presence of Christian Arabs in the region. It's a small minority, probably 2 to 3% of the Arab population, and yet people. For example, this Palestinian Lutheran pastor, Mitri Raheb, from Bethlehem, talks about winning the enemy, not winning the war or winning a state, winning the enemy by transforming the enemy into a neighbor. So he wants to continue to relate to Israelis as people and to have them relate to the Palestinian people as well. And so he has a very hopeful response, and it may be that the Christian presence in Palestine may contribute something very important. He challenges the rest of us as well to be ambassadors of reconciliation and to challenge our government as well to be justice brokers and peacemakers in the Holy Land, and to partner with Palestinian Christians to be ambassadors of reconciliation and thus help realize God's will in Jesus' homeland. This is going to be in the Lutheran in July, so I don't have to read all of it to you. And also that map that I've been passing around is going to be in the Lutheran in July, so there's a lot of good reading in the Lutheran. So we have 5 minutes, and I, before I'm going to close with a prayer from Pax Christi, Muslim Jewish Christian Prayer for Peace. But in the 5 minutes that we have, perhaps we have people with some perspectives on some of the issues and the challenges. Yes?
Question for future. We leave before your class tomorrow. Do you have any recommendations for ways to look up what you're talking about or a little bit off?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. There's so many good things on the web. There's also a Christian peacemaking team, Christian peacemakers team, that's Mennonite, but you can get on their email list and they'll send you reports from Hebron and other places. And they're there as observers and to be in solidarity, both with Israeli peace groups and also with the Palestinian people. I have a number of different email addresses. Perhaps what I can do is get them to you, and I can get a list for other people tomorrow. Do people have names right off the bat? I'm sorry, I'm blanking on things right now.
You can just put it on the bulletin board.
Okay, I can do that. Mm-hmm. Because there's a whole, the ELCA right now has now a liaison that does a lot of this kind of thing. I get email things every day,
it seems. Ann Hafton, right?
Ann Hafton sometimes does that. There's also another person who's actually been, there's ELCA. If you go to the Lutheran on the web, the Lutheran, and look up the July issue. I have that right here. I printed it out so you can get July a little earlier. But it says here, you can get all these things, you can get websites. Oh, great. Tikkun, that's a Jewish magazine devoted to justice issues. Palestinian Refugee Research Net, Lutheran World Relief's Response to the Middle East Crisis. Oh, this is good. The Middle East Council of Churches. Statement from the International Council of Churches and so forth. Okay, so anybody who's interested in any of these, the names are all listed. Thank you.
Question?
Yeah.
What do you make of Bush's, I saw the thing in the paper that he plans that he thinks, what was it, Palestinian state in 3 years?
Yes.
But the only thing that has to happen is Erica has to go. It's only a headline that I didn't read the full article. What credibility or hope are you giving to that?
Well, we've had a UN resolution recently calling for the creation of a Palestinian state. We've had the Saudi proposal floated, not directly to the Israelis, but around, and Bush has been talking with Saudi representatives. The Egyptians have been involved. Yes, and now Bush, and I think Powell especially, would want to see a positive vision, you know, beyond this military control. So, well, there's some insurmountable, there's some tough issues still, aren't there? But I'm very glad that he's calling for that, and I hope that it's more than just just talk. You know, recently now Ariel Sharon also is calling for is saying, oh yes, there'll be a Palestinian state. But once Ariel Sharon starts getting that language, then I start becoming more doubtful of it. But I think Powell especially is very concerned about the Palestinians, and Kofi Annan I think is very concerned, and so I'm very hopeful that there are people at that level that have their eye over there. Shall we close with a prayer from Pax Christi USA? It's a Muslim Jewish Christian prayer for peace. Oh God, you are the source of life and peace. Praise be your name forever. We know it is you who turn our minds to thoughts of peace. Hear our prayer in this time of war. Your power changes hearts. Muslims, Christians, and Jews remember and profoundly affirm that they are followers of the one God, children of Abraham, brothers and sisters. Enemies begin to speak to one another. Those who were estranged join hands in friendship. Nations seek the way of peace together. Strengthen our resolve to give witness to these truths by the way we live. Give us understanding that puts an end to strife, mercy that quenches hatred, and forgiveness that overcomes vengeance. Empower all people to live in your law of love. Amen. Thank you.